Hello, I'm Sam Doucette. This is number 0578, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0578. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll actually meet two guests that were stories I was looking into, delving into for the Stuff File news, but wanted to dig a little deeper. Richard DeVries is an environmental psychologist in Amsterdam who has created an environmentally friendly outdoor urinal to cut down on peeing in alleys called green peas.
And I think about a lot of things that help, like creating ownership or the sense that someone is watching. That works, but just places the problem to another alley. The need for peeing still stays. So I want to create something and facilitate something that people can pee, but then on a positive way. So that also some nice to look. So that's why I invented the combination of a planter and a urinal.
Paul Durham is the operator of Ghost Cruise Tours. He takes passengers on a ferry around the anchored cruise ships off the English coast that have all ceased operations due to the pandemic.
You never see a ship at anchor. It's usually in port, and there's always a building or something in front of it. We can literally circumnavigate this massive ship, which can be up to one-fifth of a mile long. We can circumnavigate it at only a distance of 50 meters. When we get back, I always ask the passengers, did you think we could get that close to a ship? And no is the answer.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter goes to the mean streets of Vancouver to help Dr. Julie Reese stop a new, deadlier opioid crisis in Dr. Daniel Kavala's new thriller, The Last High. So get your stethoscope. We're on the case later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0578, was Sam Doucette, the program director at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. They're at the University of Winnipeg and have been campus and community radio since 1963. They're also one of the places you can hear the Stuff File program. And you can check out their website at ckuw.ca. And if you didn't catch all that, you know, you can just simply go to our website, thestufffile.com, look up the show number for this program, which is show number 0578, which you just heard Sam say, and you'll find the link. Thank you very much, Sam, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, and thank you very much for playing the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, we're living in a time when nerves are frayed and tempers are short, which I'm guessing is the genesis for this story. A 34-year-old Wichita, Kansas man died after a disagreement over leftover barbecue beans escalated. On August the 2nd, Ryan Sprite returned to his home that he shared with his uncle, 57-year-old David Staley, and went to the kitchen where Staley questioned him about eating the beans. Staley told police Sprite became upset, pushing and punching Staley, who in response picked up a knife from the counter and jabbed Ryan one time in the chest. Staley was charged with voluntary manslaughter. Wow. Fighting over beans. Something tells me he'll get pretty darn used to prison food. Yeah. And here's a story that I just love. 94-year-old World War II veteran Suddy Economy of Roanoke, Virginia, developed a taste for juicy fruit gum during the war and is well known around town for passing out sticks of his favorite flavor to everyone he meets. Now Economy has been granted his dying wish, to be buried in a casket painted to look like a package of Juicy Fruit gum. After initially having his request for permission turned down, Economy's friend Sammy Oki, who was the owner of Oki's funeral service, received a call from a Mars Wrigley Company vice president approving the use of its logo. The company even delivered 250 packs of gum to Economy's family. Meanwhile, Economy is still breathing and living at the Virginia Veterans Care Clinic, where his health is thankfully improving.
Juicy fruit, the taste is gonna move ya!
You know, if his health improves enough that he can be up and about, Juicy Fruit should put him in a commercial. That's the least they can do for such brand loyalty. Meanwhile, 47-year-old Cynthia Lynn Teeple of Jacksboro, Tennessee, was charged with public intoxication after Campbell County Sheriff's deputies found her topless in a La Follette backyard with two miniature horses on August the 30th. This sounds like a Catherine the Great story. Anyway, the homeowner told deputies Teeple had been eating grass and dirt from the horse's enclosure and also chewed on one of the horse's manes. Teeple then volunteered that the horse's hair is made of Laffy Taffy and Airhead candy. According to the arrest report, she admitted she had taken methamphetamine the day before. Was she trying to eat the horse or just talk to the horse?
A horse is a horse, of course, and no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. A.
Wow. Could you imagine if she were trying to talk to the horse and the horse talked back?
Hello, I'm Mr. A.
Nay, I say. Nay. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, let's check to see what we have in medical news.
Please state the nature of the medical emergency.
I was just getting to that. An unnamed 17-year-old girl in Bokaro, India, underwent surgery on August 31st to remove a 15-pound hairball from her stomach following years of obsessive hair chewing. Oh, please tell me the hair she was chewing was her own. Maybe she thought it was Laffy Taffy. Anyway, a team of doctors, led by Dr. G.N. Sahu, initially thought the mass was a tumor.
It's not a tumor.
But discovered the hairball during the six-hour surgery. You know, they should have gotten a hair specialist, like Cousin It.
Are you sure Cousin It is our man?
Oh, sure. He's precise. He would handle the case with hair. Anyway, the girl was reported to be in stable condition following the procedure.
Hello, I'm Mr. Rayer.
No, not that kind of stable. Meanwhile, doctors at a hospital in Dagestan, Russia, were shocked to discover the source of a woman's stomach distress was a 4-foot-long snake that had apparently slithered into her mouth as she slept outside her home in Lavashi village.
Just you wait till I get you in my coils.
In a video of the procedure, a doctor is heard to say, "Let's see what this is," as a tube was inserted down the anesthetized woman's throat. Local residents say such incidents are not unheard of in the mountainous area. Wow. She'd probably like sushi. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Officials in Amsterdam have installed 12 hemp-filled urinals around the city's notorious red-light district in an attempt to control, if not eliminate, late-night public urination or wild peeing. The boxes, called green peas, resemble planters, and the hemp filters inside turn urine into an organic fertilizer and water that feed the plants on top. Inventor Richard DeVries came up with the idea and claims there was a 50% reduction in wild peeing. Richard is on the line via Skype from Amsterdam to talk about it. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Peter. Yeah, thank you for having me in the show.
Thank you for being on the program with us. Now, this was something that you created a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken. What was the impetus for doing this in the first place?
I'm an environmental psychologist. Cities often ask me to find a solution for a different kind of nuisance. For example, littering, too much sound, young people hanging around, but also peeing in the alleys, of course. And then I think about a lot of things that help, like creating ownership or the sense that someone is watching. That works, but just places the problem to another alley. So the need for peeing still stays. So I want to create something and facilitate something that people can pee, but then on a positive way. So that also have some nice to look. So that's why I invented the combination of a planter and a urinal.
So I explained a little bit in the introduction, but tell us exactly how this works with the hemp filters.
We're now switching to another system. From the hemp filters. The hemp filters, the official idea was the hemp can be used to lessen the scent of urine. It's absorbing the ammonia, so it doesn't smell, and then can be used as fertilizer. The only problem with the hemp is that the people that maintain the green pea don't like to shuffle hemp fiber with urine. It's kind of a dirty job. And also there's some residue from medicine also in the hemp fiber. So we now come up with a different system that we use the pure urine with an ammoniac blocker and then make 10% biological fertilizer and 90% drinking water. And that was the system that was developed for the European Space Agency for Mars missions. They want to have something that is self-sustainable on Mars, so that you can use your pee to drink, but also grow vegetables on a Mars mission.
And to be clear, because I've seen pictures of the green peas, and we'll put a picture up on our website so people can take a look at it as well. But to be clear, they are planters, but it's the pee, the urine, is not just watering that specific plant. It's being collected so it can be used as fertilizer somewhere else. Is that correct?
Yeah. But also, of course, these plants are not directly the urine, because if you use the urine undiluted, it will kill the plants.
Okay.
It's too aggressive. So you have to, most simple is to dilute it with 50% water. But if you want to have the most, the nutrition of it, then you have to process it first.
So are the plants that are on the urinal, are they merely there for promotional purposes and decoration? Because, as you say, you're not directly watering those plants, right?
No, that's right. It's of course, the green and the environment. And it's also nice to look at, but also to stimulate biodiversity. For example, there's a harsh urban environment in an alley. No green at all, only concrete and gravity. But if you place the green pea over there, and we have seen that in practice, that it immediately attracts bees and butterflies. And if it attracts bees and butterflies, it also attracts other, for example, birds. So that you don't only have pigeons in the city, but also different birds, different insects. And also it gives a beautiful smell. For example, if you place lavender in a smelly alley, you get a different picture, of course.
Now, you might be scaring a few people out there, because the idea of being, of needing the call of nature, and you're going around bees, doesn't necessarily attract to some people.
That could be, you know, but they're very sweet green bees, so they're not aggressive.
Now, I found this very interesting when I read the story, and you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Of course, you have urinals not just on in outdoor urban settings, but you also have urinals in indoor places. Yeah. Could this situation also work in places where urinals are used a lot, like bars and restaurants, to help clean up and beautify what is normally the urinal system when you go into some of those establishments.
Yeah, of course, but it's the best to place it outside and not inside of the building.
Right.
But the main advantage is for the Greenpeace is that you don't have to use a sewage and you don't have to plug it into a water system, so you can place it anywhere. And that's for the older cities and also for example, city of New York. That a lot of cables and sewage and all things right beneath the surface, so you cannot drill in there. So it's not impossible to place a normal toilet or urinal that must be plugged to sewage and water.
Now so you
this is also a big it's more easy to use.
You first worked with city council in Amsterdam back in 2018, yeah. And you installed four of these urinal planters. Yeah. How many of them do you have now, and do you plan to have even more?
We have now about 13 in Amsterdam, but also in two cities in Belgium, and two cities beside Amsterdam in the Netherlands. So for the total, we have now 20 Greenpeace. And of course, we want to have more because the main goal is to save drinking water and also reuse essential nutrition that you normally flush to the toilet.
And as I said earlier, you claim that there was a 50% reduction in wild peeing when these were put in?
Yeah, they had an external bureau, had an evaluation, and the results was there was a 50% reduction of wild peeing in notorious places, hotspots, where was nuisance from wild peeing for over a decade.
Wow, that's impressive.
So that's a great result, yeah.
Besides the Netherlands, are you planning on expanding this? Have you gotten any interest from other places, other countries around the world?
All over the world, Bermuda, San Antonio, but also Iceland, Bangladesh, India. Yeah, we got email from all over the world. So I hope we'll.
You've mentioned some varied locations. I'm assuming this works better in warmer climes.
Holland isn't quite a warmer climate, but about water saving, that could be, of course, very useful in places where there's not enough water.
Now, if a city council, if a municipality, a province, a state, someplace found this interesting and wanted to find out more information, how can they get more information? How can they get in contact with you?
They can, of course, look at our English website. It's the greenpeace.nl/en/. But if you look at the greenpeace.nl, you can find the information. But also you can send me an email at info@greenpeace.nl. And I'd be glad to give answers to all the questions, of course.
You know, I was just thinking, this would be also something that would be interesting on places, like when we get back to normal again, when we're not so much social distancing, when things are back to normal. This would be something that I would think every college campus would want.
Yeah, of course. You can also give it the design from the campus, in the colors of the campus. But also a good sustainability statement for the campus.
Exactly.
If you want to save water and
It's a brilliant idea. And Richard, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
You're welcome, Peter. You're welcome.
Richard DeVries, the inventor of Greenpeace urinals. This really is a marvelous idea. I urge you to go to the Stuff File program website and check out the link to their site because this really is a unique solution to two problems, so-called wild peeing, and also environmental improvements and sustainability. So go to the website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0578, and you'll find the link to their site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the operator of Ghost Cruise Tours. Plus, we have Stuart Nolman in with another edition of Book Banter. And we have an idiot of the day coming your way, of course, a little later on. And much more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? It was midnight, and 50-year-old Cal Meisner was in bed at his home on Bowen Island, British Columbia, listening to the heavy rain. He remembered he had left the windows open in his pickup truck and slipped into his Croc shoes and popped out to close them. Meisner stepped up on the running board and turned the key to get the power, and there was this huge flash and bang, he said. The one Croc blew about 12 feet across the road, and the right one kind of dropped underneath the truck. He, or his truck, had been hit by lightning, but other than what paramedics called unsurprising high blood pressure and a racing heart, he was uninjured. While experts say the truck dissipated the lightning bolt, not his shoes, Meisner credits them with saving his life. "I know they aren't high on people's fashion lists," he said, "but I have a new respect for Crocs, I'll tell you that." Well, the fact that he was hit by lightning and he also has a new respect for Crocs makes him rare and unusual on several counts. Authorities say a man applied to work at a pizzeria and got $220 worth of tips, but a news report of his achievement does not say the man was actually hired. Wilmer Chinchilla, who does work at the pizzeria in North Catasasqua, Pennsylvania, told authorities the man submitted his contact information, giving the name Nicholas Mark, and then took the tip jar and ran. Chinchilla chased him but gave up when the fleeing man drew a knife. A backpack found at the pizzeria contained some things with Mark's name and some syringes. The 22-year-old suspect was arrested on charges including robbery and is held on $35,000 bail. Wow, that's a high price to pay when you're only stealing for tips. Police are searching for a man they say caught fire after he tried to set another man's car ablaze at a North Carolina convenience store. Detectives say the arson suspect, who has been nicknamed Smokey, was apparently upset that he didn't get the help he wanted from a driver, so he set the man's car on fire. Charlotte Mecklenburg police say Michael Bumpers asked a customer at a Circle K store if they had a car jack. The customer said no. Investigators say Bumpers wasn't happy with that answer, so he proceeded to pour an accelerant on the car and set it on fire. Said Detective Adrian Johnson, "There was no altercation. All the victim stated to the suspect was that he didn't have a car jack. It's unknown why the suspect committed the act that he did." Several people who frequent the convenience store said they'd be on alert until Bumpers, who police say is a regular in the area, is caught. The arson happened in July, but police are still searching for Bumpers. Wow. Right about now, he must be looking like a relief map. Of course, maybe he just spent all that time looking for a jack. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have another story of a man who apparently just doesn't take no for an answer when he asks a simple request. A man in California's Lucerne Valley says 56-year-old Mitchell Clay, his neighbor, had come to his house to ask for milk and eggs. When the man said he didn't have any, Clay became upset and told him he had 5 minutes to leave because he was going to come back to kill him. Sure enough, the unidentified victim says Clay went home and then returned with two guns and started shooting at his house. The victim fled to his car as Clay continued to shoot at him and drove to the sheriff's substation to report the crime. Deputies responded to the scene and arrested Clay on attempted murder and weapons charges. Wow, he ran to his car. I guess he already knew Clay was a lousy shot. You know, like the bad guys in every television show you've ever seen. Meanwhile, Clay really had a hankering for milk and eggs. Do you think he might have just been jonesing for pancakes?
I want pancakes! God, you people understand every language except English. Yo quiero pancakes. Donnez-moi pancakes. Click, click, bloody click, pancakes!
Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Paul Durham of Dorset on the southwest coast of England worked on cruise ships all over the world for 27 years before settling down and taking over two local ferries in Muddiford. As he gazed out to the English Channel recently, he's seen some of the world's most famous cruise ships moored and sidelined by the coronavirus pandemic, and he hit upon an idea, using his ferries to conduct tours around the huge empty vessels. Ghost Cruise Tours offers 2.5-hour trips to a socially distanced 30 passengers at a time and has become a hit. Paul joins us on the line from Dorset to talk about it. Hi, Paul.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us. They say that necessity is the mother of invention. So, as I mentioned, you got this idea gazing out of the English Channel at these ghost ships, basically. How many are normally moored in the area that you live in at any given time?
We went out today and there was four ships out there. We've had up to six and occasionally it goes down to one or two. But I know the captain's on a couple of the ships, so I can talk to them and get the inside information whether they're going to be there or not.
Now, they're not completely ghost ships. They have to be staffed to a certain amount of people. But how many people would be on any of these given ships at any time?
Yeah, I'm guessing about 80 to 100. You've got some people on the bridge. You've got people in the engine room. You'll have an electrician or two. And then you'll have the hotel staff to look after all those people.
And again, to give us an idea of what the normal capacity is, 80 people on these ships right now, when it's normal times and they're a sea, how many people, how many crew?
The smallest ship we got out there is the Aurora. I've actually been on that one. I worked on that one for a while when she was new. She holds about 1,900 passengers and about 800, well, nearly 900 crew. There is one out there called the Allure of the Seas. She can take an incredible 6,000 passengers. And her crew complement is 2,200. So it's they are certainly ghost ships.
Wow. So when you came up with this idea, I'm guessing you weren't quite sure how successful they might be. Were you concerned at all that some people would want to see the ghost ships? Are you surprised by the success?
As we came out of lockdown, the ferry wasn't doing very well, our conventional ferry from Muddiford Quay to Muddiford Beach. So I just made an announcement one day. Anybody want to go and see the ships? Because every time you go down to Muddiford Quay, you can see them in the distance. And I was shocked. Lots of people wanted to go and see these ships. So we put it on Facebook. And lo and behold, 4 hours later, we had filled up four trips.
Wow. And as I mentioned, you're socially distancing, obviously, so you have 30 passengers at a time. For you, what is a normal complement of passengers when we aren't socially distancing?
Yeah, on our ferries, are licensed for 80 passengers, and as you quite rightly said, now we can get about 30 passengers on.
So what is, you worked on the ships, as I said, 27 years before settling down and taking over these two ferries. So you have a certain knowledge of these ships. You may have worked on some of the actual ships that are out there. What are the questions that people are asking you, or what are some of the insights you're able to give during your tours that people find fascinating?
Yeah, I've worked on the ship, so I can answer all the questions that the passengers on are asked. It's quite interesting. The passengers that come on our boat to go and see the cruise ships, quite a few of them have done cruises themselves. And the other thing is, the other passengers want to do a cruise. So everybody is very interested in the cruise itself. I can give some real-life stories of what happened on the Aurora, particularly on the maiden voyage of Aurora, when we went to the rescue of a timber carrier that had sunk a few hours ahead of us.
Yes, please, share that story.
Okay, so we're in the Taiwan Strait, and we had a distress message came through. A timber carrier had sunk about three hours ahead of us, so we steamed to that position. When we got there, we saw upturned life rafts, life buoys, and an incredible amount of, it wasn't even timber really, it was trees, it was massive big trees, and a 5-meter swell. We searched the area for another hour, and we saw three survivors in the water. So under arduous conditions, we launched our rescue boat, bearing in mind it was a 5-meter swell at the time. And we managed to pull the three people out of the water. One didn't make it, and the other two, apart from suffering from hypothermia, were fine. Our next port of call was Hong Kong, and we had to get a letter from the chief officer of this timber carrier to say he had to abandon ship within 40 minutes. Well, the ship sunk from underneath him in 40 minutes, which is incredibly quick. And he had no documents on him, so we had to get him to write a letter. And I've actually kept a copy of that letter, and I've laminated it, and I give it to our passengers on board so they can read all about it.
Wow, fascinating stuff. Now, again, as you mentioned, these ships are huge. You mentioned the complement that it can have as far as staff and passengers. These are big vessels. Your ferry is not. How physically close do you get to these things? And they just must really dwarf your vessel.
Yeah, our ferry is 10 meters long. These vessels are, I'm changing into feet now, but these vessels are up to about 1,000 feet long. So what's that, about 360 meters long. Their beam going from left to right is usually about 32 meters should they wish to fit through the Panama Canal. And we are allowed to go within 50 meters of these vessels. Bearing in mind the vessels are probably 50 meters high, we're literally looking up at 45 degrees at these ships.
So it's like being in an urban center and looking up at skyscrapers.
Exactly. And the advantage is you never see a ship at anchor. It's usually in port, and there's always a building or something in front of it. We can literally circumnavigate this massive ship, which can be up to 1/5 of a mile long. We can circumnavigate it at only a distance of 50 meters. When we get back, I always ask the passengers, did you think we could get that close to a ship? And no is the answer.
What are some of the questions, common questions that the passengers ask you?
Well, one of them asked today when we were out there, are we allowed to go on board? To which I said, not really, because they're all sort of quarantining out there. Even when a captain friend of mine joined one of his ships, he had to quarantine for 14 days in a cabin, and he had to stay there before he could take over command.
What is the reaction from the cruise companies, the fact that you're going out there and circling them and taking tourists? Do people on the ship who actually have to work there, are they waving to you guys? What's the camaraderie like?
Yep, if we see anybody on the deck, I get the passengers on our boat to wave madly at them, and sure enough, the crew are only too pleased to wave back. I think they don't get much fun out there at the moment, so any distraction is worth it. I always call up the P&O ships, which I used to work for. I generally talk to the officer of the watch and they very kindly wave a very large plywood 6-foot hand out of the bridge window at us, and we wave back.
How many tours do you do in a day, or do you do just one?
Depending on weather and tide, we did two today. We're doing one tomorrow and then one the next day. We're not making the decision on the next couple of days until we know what the weather's like.
Mm. And do you find, I mean, even though you can only take 30 passengers, do you find that as time goes on, as you do this, that people are really keen on it and there's even more interest than you thought before?
Oh, the interest has been phenomenal. It completely surpassed whatever I thought. I thought we might do one trip a week. We could do one trip a day and still not satisfy the passenger demand. The one problem we have here, because of the social distancing, instead of just using one ferry on our ferry route, on nice days, we've got to use two ferries on our ferry route to get the people over. So that's we can't fulfill the passenger requirement to go and see the ghost ships.
Because, yes, you have a regular business of actually being a ferry in addition to these tours, correct?
Yeah, so we have to honor our ferry contract with the local council, so that comes first.
Well, this is, I'm sure, a pleasant surprise to what is a very difficult time. As you say, you know, you normally have a complement of 80. You can only have 30. I'm sure that's cut into your revenues. So the idea that you can do these tours is an absolute boon to not only you, but I'm sure the community at large. Do you offer, when you offer these ghost cruise tours, is there any kind of souvenirs that people can get from you, like that letter you were referring to that was laminated?
Yeah, I saw them today. They were taking copies of those letters. Apparently, I didn't know this, but modern phones have got cameras on them as well. And obviously, people take pictures with their phones.
Well, that's fascinating. Again, it's Ghost Cruise Tours. People can find out more information by going to your website, which I believe is muddyfordferry.co.uk. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir. Yes. Thank you.
Paul, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much, sir. Pleasant talking to you.
Paul Durham, who runs Ghost Cruise Tours from local ferries around the cruise ships that are moored and sidelined in his area. A brilliant tourist idea. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0578, and you'll find links to Paul's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Stuart, is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house?
Well, yeah. His name is Hugo Z. Hackenbush. Do you have a horse that's ill?
No, I don't.
Well, on this edition of Book Banter, we are going to be dealing with doctors, but doctors who have sidelines of being best-selling novelists as well. You know what I mean?
Oh, of course I know who you mean. Someone who's been on the show many times and who I've had a lot of discussions with and whose books I truly do love.
Well, I think, Peter, you're going to like this one, because on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to review the latest medical thriller by Vancouver-based Dr. Daniel Calla.
Yes, or just Dr. Dan to me.
Dr. Dan, yeah, well, you've got that right to call him Dr. Dan. I have to be a little bit more formal than you in that respect. Maybe after I review a couple more of his books, maybe I'll get to that Dr. Dan level.
Oh, you got to go back to some of his first books, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay. Yeah. So let me set up the premise for you. So during a party in a well-to-do suburb of Vancouver, 7 teenagers are rushed to the emergency room of a local hospital as they mysteriously overdose from drinking the punch at the party that was spiked with an opioid that was alleged to be fentanyl. All but two of the teens in question are dead on arrival. One will make a complete recovery while the other constantly fights for her life. Now, a few days later, a senior airline pilot during an overnight stopover in Vancouver dies from an overdose of an illicit drug he buys from a dealer outside his hotel. And then a few days after that, a Vancouver lawyer during a swanky party, no teens there, immediately dies from taking a bought from the street opioid. Now, these mysterious deaths are just too much for toxicologist and ER doctor Julie Reese, who treated the 7 teens who overdosed during their party. Fearing a new opioid crisis that could arise on the streets of Vancouver with a little-known drug that's potentially deadlier than fentanyl, she teams up with police detective Anson Chen to find out what this new opioid is and who's responsible for manufacturing and distributing it before it kills more unsuspecting victims. Now, that is the heart-stopping premise of Dr. Daniel Calla's new medical thriller called The Last High. Now, similar to the approach that was used in Steven Soderbergh's acclaimed 2000 movie Traffic, the book takes a look at the Vancouver illicit drug scene from every aspect and every person who deals the drug and those who are directly or indirectly affected by it. From the Waite brothers, who use their thriving real estate business as a front for their narcotics trafficking for one of the violent Chinese triad gangs, to Marku, the Finnish-born dealer who insists that his addict clients use his drugs while accompanied by another person and have to carry naloxone kits in case they overdose, to the chemist who cooks the drugs for the streets from raw materials that are smuggled from China and laptop computers, to the hardened addicts who inhabit Vancouver's notorious east side, to the emergency room doctors who make it a daily part of their jobs to treat these addicts from overdosing on these new deadly opioids. Now, Dr. Calla, who is himself an emergency medicine doctor in Vancouver, uses his medical knowledge to a great extent in The Last High. Now, through the character of Dr. Reese, Calla shows how a doctor in this kind of medical practice has to be a quick-thinking medical expert one moment and a detective the next moment, as she employs these skills in order to find out what killed these innocent victims and what can be done to take this new opioid off the streets before it kills even more people in dangerous proportions. And as well, he focuses on the vulnerabilities that can plague these crusading doctors that have them ending up dealing with their own set of personal baggage. But you know what? If you want an engrossing, edge-of-receipt thriller that combines good detective work, corruption, savage criminal practices, a dark, seedy portrait of a large Canadian city, and a hard-hitting lesson on the medical and emotional effects of opioid drugs, then The Last High certainly fills that prescription.
And we should also point out that in addition to writing amazing books, this man is actually in charge of an ER, and of course he has his hands full. As this book implies, there's a big problem with the opiate situation in Vancouver, and it is also overshadowing the fact that he has to deal with COVID as well, and so he's really a busy guy.
Yeah, it's like how do you find time to write a whole book, let alone several chapters of it. While he has all his plate full with these two medical situations.
And he is an excellent writer. You mentioned this current book, The Last High, which is his new one. But I'm torn between some of his previous books as to which ones I think are the best. There's Pandemic, there's Cold Plague. One that's really ambitious is one called Of Flesh and Blood. I don't know if you've seen or read that one, but it's a story that spans literally 100 years, and it goes back and forth in time. And there's resistance. The list goes on. Blood lies. I mean, they're rage therapy. They're all great.
And no, he somehow manages to churn them out. And you know what? That, I mean, I found The Last High a very highly readable, book that just, doesn't want to let you go. And that's what I like about it. And, I think he's going to turn him into a very high profile writer of thrillers.
Well, he's already a high profile writer of thrillers.
But a higher profile.
Ironically, I have not read this one yet, but it is on my to-do list. It definitely is.
Well, hopefully by the next time, by the next Book Banter, or maybe the one after, you will have read the book and you will share my enthusiasm for it.
Well, I'm already very enthusiastic when it comes to Dr. Dan. I think he is an amazing writer. Just really is. His books are great.
Well, next time when you speak to Dr. Kala, please let him know that he's got another fan with me.
Excellent. So the book is?
It's called The Last High by Dr. Daniel Kala. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $22 in trade paperback.
And again, I'm going to mention one of the previous titles, Cold Plague. You got to read Cold Plague, Stuart.
Okay. Well, I'm going to a bookstore tomorrow, so I'll give a look and see if it's there.
I think you really like that one. And what other books do you recommend in this genre, sir?
Well, on the genre of medical thrillers, I like to highly recommend the first one I've ever read, which was Robin Cook's Coma. I read that back in the late 70s. It was also a movie with Jean-Pierre Bujold and Michael Douglas. That was a real scary thriller. That really was. And the next one is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who you see quite a lot on CNN as the resident medical specialist, who's been giving some great expert opinions on the COVID-19 crisis. He wrote a novel about doctors and ER doctors at Atlanta Hospital. It was called Monday Mornings. It was very well written. I was very impressed. And it recently became a miniseries on TNT.
Interesting. I'm surprised you didn't mention anything by Michael Crichton.
Well, you can't deny Michael Crichton his due. I mean, he's written quite a lot. And I think he's done his share of novels, medical novels too, but he also wrote a book called Five Patients, which was one of his few nonfiction works, which actually became the basis for ER, the TV series.
Mm. Again, this week's book is?
The Last High by Dr. Daniel Kala, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $22 and available in trade paperback.
And how can people find you, Stat?
Well, probably in the hospital cafeteria, where I'll be reading my latest reviews in the Montreal Times. It's available in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Now, if you excuse me, I got a code blue with hamburgers, so I got to go now.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way. And I got a couple more Stuff File news stories to share with you here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and Spotify and iHeartRadio, among other places. A customer at a Wendy's burger drive-thru asked to speak to the manager because the woman in the window was, quote, a smartass, unquote, when she asked him to pull forward to wait. 22-year-old manager Julia Martin heard the exchange and told the staff she would deliver the man's meal to his car. The customer wasn't polite either. Even before she got to his car, he threatened to call Wendy's headquarters to report the restaurant, which didn't make Martin happy at all. She allegedly punched him in the face through his car window. After beating on him for several minutes, Martin walked away, but apparently decided he needed some more correction and went back and beat him some more. She also had her keys in her hand and threw them at his face. The customer kept the keys as evidence until sheriff's deputies arrived. Deputies noticed Martin's story kept changing, and she was arrested for battery. By the way, it's unclear if the customer ever consumed his order.
Where is the beef?
Apparently, in the parking lot. By the way, I'm not saying the customer is slow or anything, but in between the time that Julia walked away and then started to walk back, wouldn't you have closed your window and locked the doors on your car?
You want something better. You're Wendy's kind of people.
Yes. This next story I actually saw a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't share it at the time because of its location. It takes place in Brockville, Ontario, a place that I lived in back in the early 80s. That's 2.5 years of my life I'll never get back. Just saying it out loud is going to trigger PTSD. I'll have Vietnam flashbacks tonight. Anyway, a man in Brockville heard his parrot in the front room say, "Hello!" But he ignored the greeting because it isn't always a reliable source of information. Sure enough, an intruder had slipped in through an unlocked door, found the homeowner's wallet, took a credit card, and left. A neighbor was a bit sharper. They noticed the stranger and took a photo of him, which matched security camera footage of a man trying to use the card at a nearby store. The unnamed 33-year-old burglar was arrested. You know, if you need a burglar alarm, buy one that doesn't need to be fed. Yeah. Oh, enough about Brockville. I'm getting the chills. After taking a sex toy from a shelf at a Florida adult novelty store, a woman removed her clothes and began using the device inside the business, and inside her business, too. A Fort Pierce police officer was dispatched to the Lion's Den Adult Superstore in reference to a disturbance, according to an arrest affidavit. En route to the business, a dispatcher noted that there was a female in the store wearing a purple shirt and had on no pants. A worker explained that the self-partying suspect had removed a sex toy from the packaging and was now fully nude. The woman, the worker added, had disappeared into a stockroom with the sex toy. When he entered the stockroom, the officer found 36-year-old Teresa Stanley sitting in an office chair with her feet up on the table. Stanley had a pink-colored sex toy in her hand and was using it. Right after the cop appeared, Stanley stopped the neck massager and dropped it on the ground. She is being held in lieu of a $1,500 bond. Well, I'm guessing she was desperately trying to find an alternative to social distancing. Yes. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff off presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police in Clearwater, Florida say 27-year-old Herbert McKellen walked into a Speedway gas station around 2 a.m. While in the store, investigators say McKellen reached over the counter to steal 13 different scratch-off lottery tickets while the clerk was distracted. He then left the store without paying for the tickets, worth $102. He didn't waste any time in checking to see if they were winners. When one ticket offered a $30 prize, he went back into the same store to cash it in. Employees called police, who arrested McKellen for petty theft and dealing in stolen property. Now, why, oh why, would you steal lottery tickets from a store, then return shortly to the same store to cash in one of the tickets when the world knows that scratch lottery tickets are officially registered to the vendor who sells them, and unless the clerk had the world's worst case of short-term memory, would know these were the same tickets that moments earlier disappeared? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0578. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0578. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.